Some of you I've met and some not. My name is Hozan Alan Sinapi, and I live and practice at Berkeley Zen Center. I've been living there for 27 years, I think. It's an indeterminate sentence. I'm a disciple of Sojin Weitzman. I think he's been here in the not too distant past, right? That's one part of my life. I've got other. I'm also a father. And my kids are growing up. One's in college, and the other one's about to go to college. And they grew up at Berkeley Zen Center, where I live with my wife Lori. I play music from time to time. I write. But aside from my practice in Soto Zen tradition, I also work in the field of what you might call engaged Buddhism, places where Buddhism and society intersect. For me, that's not, I don't see that as something unusual. Some people do, some people don't. Most recently, I'm still kind of reckoning with jet lag. I was in Burma and India for about 4 weeks, and I returned last Sunday. I was just thinking about it. I drove past the airport just thinking, wow, I was going through customs at this moment a week ago. I have been teaching regularly for the last few years at a school in sort of central India, a city called Nagpur, which most people don't know. It's one of these cities that now exist around the world of, 3 or 4 million people that we don't even know about. And the place I've been working and the group I've been working with or the communities I've been working with there are were formally designated untouchable. And a lot of them, particularly in this state, Maharashtra, have converted to Buddhism as a way of really renouncing this identity that's been placed on them and picking up a new identity of dignity and practice education, and just kind of bringing themselves up in the world. So it's a remarkable school. It's called Nagaloka, and every year there's a cohort of about 70 or 80 young people around the age, from roughly 19 to about 22, 23, some of them having finished high school, some having a little of post-high school education, college or university, or even a technical school. But they come here and they have a residential program where they have meditation twice a day. Very strong, it's required. And then during the day they have periods of work, they have classes and study on basic Buddhism, on social thought, on the kind of technique of becoming a community organizer. And some of them stay on for a second year, some of them go to go for more education, and eventually the idea is that they return to their home areas, and they come from every state in India, and both work with society there, doing social work, and also set up meditation groups. And they've been about, I think, eight or nine groups that have gone through now. It's been running for 9 years. And so there's a number of hundreds of graduates. And it's really exciting working with these young people. They're just completely alive and very warm and friendly. So I've been going there once a year, and what I'm going to share with you is something that I shared with them. And then on this trip also, I've been kind of involved with Burma for about 22 years, and in November I went to Burma with a friend from Australia, and we did a lot of visiting and some short teachings, and people wanted to have us back to do a training on what we call peace building. But really what it is about building relationship, building community, looking at the roots of conflict and how to deal with them both within oneself and between people, between organizations, how you hold different views. You know, how you can how I can hold a different view than, say, one of you without us becoming inimical to each other. And we had a 5-day residential training at a very remote monastery about 2 hours outside, north of Rangoon. And, you know, one thing that was interesting is who came. We had 6 or 7 of our 20 people who were former political prisoners. Burma is opening up now, as you may have read something about this or heard. It's really, there are all kinds of opportunities that they're not exactly confirmed, and there's, you know, great concerns about the depth of change. But still, there are changes that are happening there that are very new and that people have been waiting on for many years. So I feel like in both of these circumstances, what we're trying to teach about and open people up to is the possibility of freedom. And in a sense, that's why I began to practice Zen. And that's what I see the practice is about. That freedom, on a very intimate level, in our families, in our communities, in our society, to me, that is enlightenment. And enlightenment is freedom. So I want to talk today a little about an early teaching of the Buddha on the 7 factors of enlightenment. These are from the Pali scriptures, which are purportedly the earliest teachings of the Buddha, and from a sutta called the Gilana Sutta. So, as probably you know, there's a kind of interesting and somewhat paradoxical view of enlightenment in our Soto Zen tradition. I don't know. I'm sure this gets brought out from time to time in what you study. In a lot of Buddhist traditions, enlightenment is expressed as a kind of goal. You begin supposedly as unenlightened, and with diligent practice over time, you can perhaps become enlightened. That's seen as a goal or an objective. In fact, when he woke up under the Bodhi tree, what the Buddha said is, "Now I see that I and all beings together are enlightened." And what he was pointing to is, ultimately, beyond our delusion, beyond our misconceptions about ourselves, we have the same nature, the same enlightened nature as the Buddha. It's covered over. So, in Dogen's tradition, you have the notion of practice enlightenment. Is that familiar to some of you? So practice enlightenment is it's not that we sit to become enlightened. It's that because we have some either a grasp or a glimpse or an intuition of our own enlightenment and the enlightenment of everybody else in this circle. Because of that, naturally we just sit down. So our practice is actually an expression of enlightenment rather than a technique for attaining it. So we have this idea of practice enlightenment or practice realization. We practice because we are already enlightened. So with that in mind, and this is part of what I try to teach when I'm in India or in Burma or anywhere, is that enlightenment is not a special experience, but it's actually a way of living. When you think about the Four Noble Truths that the Buddha taught in his first teaching, the truth of that life is marked by suffering, the truth of that the cause of suffering is our attachment, our wish for things to be some way or for them not to be some way. The third truth is the truth of that there is a way to be free. And the fourth noble truth is what he called the Eightfold Path. And that just outlines a way to live an enlightened life. So when I look at people and I think about my friends or people that I encounter, I'm not so interested in whether they may or may not have had some large experience in meditation. What really interests me is how do they live? What are they doing? What is each of us doing in our life? When I look at that, then I try to consider whether, okay, is this an enlightened life? Not looking at some expression, beatific expression on someone's face or look in their eyes, but actually, what are we doing in the world? And I try to apply the same standards to myself. And sometimes I measure up, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'm acting in an enlightened way, sometimes I'm acting in a deeply deluded way, but I can bring myself back. So, coming to this text, the Gilana Sutta, the Buddha outlines seven factors or characteristics that both lead to enlightenment and also express it. In other words, if you practice these qualities or these practices, that will help you encounter yourself deeply. And if you are encountering yourself deeply, just naturally you will express yourself in these kinds of ways, which are not a conclusive list, but they're sort of general factors. So this is what they are. The first factor is mindfulness, awareness. The second is investigation or analysis. So it's looking at it technically is an investigation of the dharmas, but so it's looking at kind of moment by moment life and what it consists of. The third is effort or energy or persistence. It takes work to accomplish anything or to manifest anything. The fourth, which you don't often see on lists of Buddhist characteristics, is joy. Just to have a joy and a lightness about our life and our activities. And one of my experiences, I mean, I assume that probably a number of you knew Koban Roshi, right? Well, there's a guy who manifested joy. He just communicated it. Another person like that in our Japanese lineage, Suzuki Roshi, I believe, did. His son, Hoitsu Suzuki, if any of you know him, it's a really, sometimes people cultivate something that's in them. It just, when you're around them, you feel good. I didn't know Koban really well, but I encountered him quite a number of times, and each time, you felt really good. This quality of joy. The fifth is calmness or serenity. The ability to meet everything without agitation, regardless of how it's coming at you. The sixth factor is concentration, which is, what we're cultivating as we're sitting in Zazen cross-legged. It's you know, it takes all those things. It takes effort, it takes mindfulness, and it takes concentration, but it also generates concentration as we are sitting. We sink into a concentrated state. Concentration like, almost like distillation, or like, I don't know, like concentrated orange juice, where it's just a highly compressed version of oneself, you know, just add life and you're reconstituted. And the seventh factor is equanimity, related to calmness, but it's the ability to meet everything equally, whether it's good, bad, pleasant, unpleasant, not to be pushed out of your seat by circumstances. So those are the seven characteristics or seven factors. I thought I would just read you this this sutra, which is quite short, and it has an interesting interesting kind of personal quality. So this is the Gilana Sutta. I've heard that on one occasion, the Buddha, the Blessed One, was staying at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. So it's a very specific place to locate him. It's a real place. And on that occasion, Venerable Mahakasapa was staying in the pepper tree cave. Mahakasapa was one of his first disciple, actually, one of the senior monks. Oh, this is nice and warm. Was staying in the pepper tree cave, diseased, in pain, severely ill. In the late afternoon, the Buddha left his seclusion and went to where Mahakasapa was staying. So he went to visit him. On arrival, he sat down and said to Mahakasapa, "I hope you are getting better, Kasapa. I hope you are comfortable. I hope that your pains are lessening and not increasing. I hope there are signs of their lessening and not of their increasing." And Mahakasapa is not giving the, you know, kind of the conventional response, say, "I'm fine, you know, yeah, I'm doing okay." He says, "I'm not getting better, Lord. I am not comfortable. My extreme pains are increasing, not lessening. And there are signs of their increasing and not of their lessening." So like, oh, okay, this is not so good. And what the Buddha does was immediately his remedy. So the sickness is the sickness of life. It's dukkha that our life is marked by illness, whether it's illness of attitude, of circumstances, or, you know, real physical illness. All of these are different expressions of the same kind of the same existential reality that we have a body. And if we have a body, it has its strengths, but it invariably has its weaknesses. So what the Buddha says, he teaches the seven factors of enlightenment. He said, "Kasapa, these seven factors for awakening rightly taught by me, when developed and pursued, lead to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. Which seven?" And he goes through mindfulness, as a factor for awakening, rightly taught by me, when developed and pursued, leads to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. Analysis of qualities, effort or persistence, joy, serenity or tranquility, concentration, equanimity, kashapa, these are the seven factors for awakening rightly taught by me that developed and pursued lead to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. In other words, to freedom and to wellness. That is what the Blessed One said. Gratified, Venerable Mahakashapa delighted in the Blessed One's words, and Venerable Mahakashapa recovered from his disease. That was how Venerable Mahakashapa's disease was abandoned. And that's the whole story. So the question is, how do we live? And what, just a little more about these factors. Like mindfulness, in Pali, is the word is sati, and it has some interesting alternative translations. One of them is right remembering. Remembering where we are, remembering what we're doing. Another word is right recollection. And those words are interesting, remembering and recollection. It's like taking these the scattered parts of ourselves and reintegrating, bringing them together in the moment. That's what mindfulness is. Investigation or analysis, as I said, it's technically investigating the dharmas, if you will, the factors of our, the elements, the kind of building blocks of our thinking and feeling. But really, I see it as looking at all causes and conditions that, in order to be mindful, we need to be able to investigate what constitutes the here and now. What's really happening? Where does it come from? Does it have causes that we can understand? And in order to do that, it takes effort. This is work. It's work to, you know, it's like there's, in my habit mind anyway, I mean, to think about recollection or remembering, it's like there's a centrifugal force of my spinning mind that kind of wants to go off in all directions. So it takes effort to sit upright and bring myself back to my breath, back to my posture. I can do it. Then kind of my wily monkey mind will scatter off, and I have to keep bringing it back. So that takes effort. But that effort is joyful. And the joy is interesting to me. It, the first three of these factors are something that I have to do. Joy is not something I can do. Joy is something I can let arise and happen. You know, I'm not sure I had an awful lot of joy in maybe my first 10 years of Zazen. It was hard. And one day I noticed, I feel very light. And then I realized, oh, this is happening with some regularity when I sit down. It just, the kind of weight, mental weight, burdens of different kinds seem to drop away. And when you peel those things away, there's a kind of joy and lightness. And I must say that when I've met people who I consider awake, and that's not just Buddhists, it's, you know, in any tradition, and all of us meet people like that. In fact, all of us are people like that at moments. But when you meet people who have really practiced whatever their tradition is deeply and long, often there's a lightness to them that just communicates, and it's encouraging. They weren't, I mean, when you know some of their stories, you know, oh, they weren't born that way. This was, and they didn't make themselves this way. This is a fruit of the practice. So it's just a joy in being alive and in being able to have a practice, some way to manifest, to be able to smile in difficulty. That's also one of the amazing things that I encountered in Asia, and people whose circumstances are a lot harder than ours or than mine. To meet, say, people who've been imprisoned unjustly, and to find them able to smile, to understand that there's a kind of joy, is a kind of underground stream that flows through and supports one's practice in life. And there's calmness and serenity, the ability to be undisturbed, to be like the ocean, which on the top is wave-tossed and can be turbulent, and in the depths is just steep, deep, and relatively still and moving slowly, not disturbed, just very settled. And the concentration is really the ability to focus one's mind, to be single-pointed when one needs to be. Sometimes that point is very narrow and tight, and sometimes that point is vast. You know, some concentration is an element of our zazen practice. But I think that the concentration in Soto Zen is a sort of peculiar formulation. It's not expressed this way, but the way I think of it is, concentrate on everything. To have a large, what Suzuki Roshi talked about, to have a large, open, soft mind. That's a kind of concentration as well. And then finally, equanimity. To be able to balance, to be able to stand right at the intersection of forces. Balance doesn't mean being rigidly locked in place. Think of a tree or a blade of grass, which are eminently balanced. They're upright. If the wind blows, they move one way or the other. And they have an equanimity which tends to bring them back towards the center. We are like that. It's not that we're always on point or on center. If an emotion comes, if a thought comes, if a condition arises in our life, we're moved off a little to one direction or the other. Equanimity is the ability to just return towards the middle. So these are factors of enlightenment. They're one of a variety of sort of dharma systems that overlap. But I think they really give us tools for how to practice a whole life. That includes being here on the cushion, being in the zendo, as one dimension of our lives. And it includes, ultimately, our activities in every realm, our work, our family, our psychology, our engagement in society as a whole. So I think I'll end there. Maybe have a few minutes for questions or comments. I'm aware of the time. So thank you very much. If you have some question or thought, I'd like to hear.
Questions on every aspect. One particularly, I'm wondering if you can contrast the untouchables and their status and development in India with the native and black cultures in America and so forth, where that's gone and is going.
Well, I think that there are a lot of parallels. And there are also parallels in the fact that the oppression and discrimination is ongoing. There, I think, the violence is often a lot more on the surface than it tends to be in our society right now. But in each case, it's like the dominant culture is telling some group of people, you are less. Mm-hmm. You are less than human. And so I think there are quite a number of parallels. And one of the key thinkers, inspiring figures of the untouchable movement was a man called B.R. Ambedkar. Ambedkar was a remarkable young man who, against all odds, won scholarships, and he ended up with like 3 PhDs and was the main author of the Indian Constitution. But he studied here, and when he studied here in the United States in basically the teens or the early 20s, he made very close contact with African Americans, and there's a really interesting set of dialogues and letters, exchanges that he had with F.W. Du Bois. So there are parallels.
Yeah. Thank you for your talk. And apologize for the incense and things. We had a group here and we didn't get things back in order.
That's fine.
So, I like the topic of practice enlightenment because, like you said, it's kind of a cornerstone of the Soto Zen lineage and practice. And I always find it interesting when I start to contemplate it, that I almost feel like it's also a slippery slope, because, you know, I feel like I've gone down this road, and I see others go down this road in the practice where everything that we do is practicing enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I feel like, you know, whatever changes that the practice has done to me for any awakening that I might have gone through in my practice has come from the stillness and depth of that I find in Zazen. And I don't think that the way that I practice in my life, my day-to-day affairs and relationships that I hold, and way that I cut the wood or speak to a friend or a family member, I think that the equanimity that I've developed in those relations comes from my experience in Zazen. So, in one sense, I can relate to that the importance is seeing how a person lives their life, but I almost feel like the quality of a person's awakeness in the way that they live their life is a direct reflection of their experience in Zazen. Not that there's everyone has to have this grand awakening experience, but to taste the truth of stillness of that Zazen mind is the only way that I think that one can express awakened mind in their life.
Well, I'm not sure it's the only way, but it's the way we've been given. Mm. That's why I want to be careful, because even the experience of the methodology or the technology of different forms of Buddhism varies. And, you know, this is what I relate to. But I think that within this tradition, what I come to look for is what you learn by sitting in the laboratory of the Zendo is you can contact that stillness, that depth. And you also can contact it. I come in the Zendo with whatever it is I've been doing and whatever it is I'm going to. And sometimes I sit down and it begins in turbulence. But because we have this practice, even in the turbulence, if I'm willing to endure it, I can find intimations and actual experiences of that stillness. So the stillness is very important. And the stillness is also dynamic. It's not unmoving. It's just its movements are very subtle. And you can become attuned to that. And gradually, the purpose of meditation to me is not... It's hard to talk about purpose. But the method that we have, what we do, and that's the bell for lunch, huh? Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll finish up. I just want to say, our practice at Berkeley Zen Center, it's very interesting. When we leave the Zendo, when you leave the Zendo here, what do?
We go eat lunch.
No, I mean, how do you physically leave this space?
We turn and gusher.
You turn and bow towards the altar?
The altar.
Or the room?
The Zendo, Sangha, all
right.
three treasures.
Right. We don't do that in Berkeley. It's very interesting. It's like the only Zendo I've ever seen where you don't do that. We go to the door. We stand at the door facing out. And we give a small shashu bow. Not a gassho, not something that really demarks moving from one space to another, but just kind of acknowledging, this is a kind of liminal experience. I'm bringing my zazen. I'm not going to a different space. I'm bringing my zazen mind outside, just over this space from one room into the larger room of the world. If that makes any sense.
Is this going in or coming out?
Out.
Okay.
In, we turn, we step a few steps in and we turn towards the altar and bow to the room. But just out. So it's not finishing something. It's not concluding something. It's just moving that mind into the world.
It's a beautiful expression.
Yeah, it's really great. I think this was Sojin's invention. But it's also, and then if the teacher is there, if Sojin is there, he does what people used to do with Suzuki Roshi. He stands by the door. Mm-hmm. And so you just meet him, you bow to him, and then you turn and walk out. Mm-hmm. So he'll bow to each person, look them in the eye. And so you have this aspect of within all these factors. To me, the heart of it is relationship, being in relationship to oneself and being in relationship to the world.